Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 219, Tools for the Journey. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And we are thrilled to be back here again for what we're calling the regular episodes of Judaism Unbound, although nothing really is regular these days. But we are also doing these midweek special editions where we're talking about the times in which we are currently existing and trying to do some analysis and some futurism. And we're trying to get Judaism Unbound in our regular Friday episodes kind of back on track in the sense of having interviews with interesting people that are driving interesting things forward in the Jewish world. Now, part of the temptation there is to not be all coronavirus all the time and to really just go back and have some interviews that are more about the big picture things that we're talking about on Judaism Unbound. And yet, isn't everything that we've been talking about in Judaism Unbound tied into what a lot of us are experiencing right now? So we're in this middle place, this perhaps wilderness of trying to figure out where we are exactly as Judaism Unbound. And there's nobody better to help us navigate the wilderness than Amichai Lau-Lavi. So we're really excited to have you back again. And let me just give a few words of introduction. We're doing these live, so usually we do our introductions in post-production, so they're a little bit more formal, but just a little less formally, Amichai Lau-Lavi is the founding spiritual leader of Lab Shul in New York City, which bills itself as an everybody-friendly, artist-driven, God-optional, experimental community for sacred Jewish gatherings based on New York City and reaching the world. And that's a part that I think is extra special true today. So I hope we'll be able to get into that a little bit. Amichai is also the creator of an organization called Storytelling, and he has rabbinic ordination from the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. One other note that I would say about Amichai Lau-Lavi is that he has been, for many years, even before he was a rabbi officially, he was sort of the rabbi to the creative class of the Jewish world, the super creative artists out all over the world through an organization primarily called Reboot, but also beyond that. And so there's a lot of things that we talked about when he was on before about the role of artists, and I think there'll be a lot today again. So Amichai, welcome back to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you again.
Thank you, friends. Good to see you alive and functioning and helpful and safe and sound. Thank you for everything you've been doing.
And you. So we thought we would jump in really with something that I've been, to say I've been thinking about it would be an understatement. I've been basically obsessed about it, which is the question of what our tradition teaches us or has to teach us, what our wisdom has to offer us in a time like this that's not trite. You know, I think that if we take seriously that we are part of a 3,000 plus year old wisdom tradition, even if that wasn't how it packaged itself, and it is how it packages itself, but even if it wasn't, you would expect that a 3,000 year old civilization has a lot of wisdom accumulated to deal with difficult crises because it's been there before. And I feel that all the more so our tradition, which has packaged this wisdom into a set of stories, whether those stories are found in the Torah, in the Bible elsewhere, in the Talmud, or all kinds of other places, like I fundamentally believe that we know what to do in this time, even though all of us feel we don't know what to do. And I'm trying to sort that out and trying to think that through. And I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about where you're thinking along those lines, because you actually have been a person for quite a number of years now who has been helping people understand the wisdom and through a process called storytelling, where you really have brought back this idea that in the old days, really people couldn't read the Torah back then either. And they had people who were interpreters of various kinds who would help people navigate and understand what the deep messages here are that we really need today. And so could you share where your storytelling head is these days?
Well, I do think that we are very lucky now, as always, and especially now, to be the heirs of a very rich tradition and mythology that has a vocabulary for the best and for the worst of times. And the role of mythology and spiritual vocabulary, if it's the Odyssey or if it's Shakespeare, if it is whatever poetry animates you, and if it is the Bible, they contain seeds of meaning. So we're speaking now, it's the eve of the last day of Pesach, Shvi Shel Pesach, the seventh day, where according to tradition, our humbled and terrified ancestors crossed the sea. Part of my second Seder routine late night after party was to watch the 1923 silent version of the Ten Commandments, which is the C.C. DeMille original. It's 2 hours. It's like a preach. It's like it's preachery, but the first hour is leaving Egypt, the Exodus. So what is the story about? What does it mean for us to cross the sea? What does it mean for somebody who wrote the story that way, wrote the famous poem that way? Imagine being a slave in Egypt and imagining what it would look like at the end, right? Would you have imagined that, the sea? So that I'm thinking about, we're in the middle of something and there's so much speculation. What helps me just take the next step in whatever the metaphor of Mitzrayim is, the narrow place? So I'll share with you a story about a myth that has been with me that totally echoes what you're saying. So I'm in Harlem in New York. I've been home now for exactly a month. On Sunday, 2 days ago, for the first time with gloves and mask and headphones, I took a bike and I rode to the Central Park. It's about a 25-minute ride. And I had my music on, and at some point the song came on. This Israeli song by Yishai Ribo, who's like a, I don't know if he's Haredi, but he's like a very religious musician. And he has a song called My Heart, Halev Sheli, that just came on for my Spotify. And I haven't heard it in a long time. And it's a prayer. It's a broken heart song. It's a huge hit. I just found a Yiddish version of it. And it's the metaphor of being on, of crossing the sea. There's this beautiful metaphor that what a slave woman saw on the sea when it opened, Ezekiel didn't see. Like there was a moment in our human history, in our human mythology, and I would say the Exodus story is way beyond Jewish, right? It's a human part of our canon, that there was a moment there where the lowliest maidservant felt, saw, witnessed something that no great prophet later on was able to achieve. Wow. I don't care if it happened or not. I'm not going to go down that argument. The story exists. This metaphor exists. This something broke to break a mold, a reality, an as is, to create an as if. So the song of Yishai Ribo is that moment. It's a beautiful song. It's a beautiful tune. As soon as it came on, I felt a tear come down. A block later, I was crying so hard, I had to stop and just catch my breath in the middle of hardly anybody, people, but with masks. And I was really weeping. Like, it's been a while since I had a breakdown. The last one was in the front of the condiments in a supermarket late night. You know, I'm trying to
what specifically?
Keep strong. The condiments.
Yeah.
I don't remember what it was. I was like, soy sauce, do I need soy sauce? I don't know, soy sauce. It was very prosaic. It's a few weeks ago. But this moment, stopping by the side of the road, really weeping, having a memory of being with friends, with a bunch of Israeli friends, musicians, and somebody started playing that song. And someone else started playing with, and someone else started singing. And before you know it, the entire beach is singing and dancing. Egyptians, Israelis, Jordanians, old, young, tourists. It was a rare moment of human unity. It's on video somewhere. Someone was like, oh my God, I got to take, you know, it was like one of those, let's post those things. So I'm going back to this me weeping on side of Malcolm X on the way to the park with a song, which is a modern artistic rendition of an ancient poetic mythic rendition of the human wisdom that our Semitic ancestors wove into our vocabulary, that there are going to be moments when you will be horrified between a sea you don't know how to cross and an army of trouble behind you, then what? So I feel we're in that right now. And there are tools in our toolkit that we've inherited, and the poetry and the mythology and Yishai Ribo and Ezekiel and Exodus and the Song of Miriam and the drums and the drama, that's there for us to utilize. And I feel a lot of us now are looking for the ways to utilize these tools.
Can we talk a little bit about just some of the specifics, in particular an area that I've heard from you both versions, I mean, not both versions, but both perspectives. I mean, now you're talking about the pain that you experienced, whether it was riding on your bike or in the store. And yet you're also in a leadership position trying to help people navigate through this situation, which is both a Jewish situation and a extra Jewish situation. It's kind of interesting on that level that there are two things happening in parallel that some people are experiencing as separate, some people are experiencing as not separate. But what I'm thinking about in terms of the myth, and where I think the myth is so powerful and so right, is things like the golden calf happening not too long later. And I know you have a much more complex take on the golden calf, which we talked about on the podcast and which we can get back into. But it also represents, I think, potentially at least, the idea that there is this deep yearning to go back to the way things were, or some version of the known, when at the same time, it's probably true, both Jewishly and beyond the Jewish, right? So many of us are talking about, well, maybe now we'll talk about healthcare differently, you know, for everybody. There's so many things in our society that perhaps this is an acceleration of needing to take a different look at. And yet, how do we live through it and also solve it, you know, or also move forward is a better word, at the same time when there's this, where everybody is carrying this pain. And I think that the natural direction where that pain takes you is to try and go back, whether that is through some kind of sentimental experience or an actual effort to go back. And I'm kind of concerned as I sit here that people, we're all going to try to go back when this is over, and that that wouldn't be the right thing to do. And yet, how do we lead in a time like this when we also are feeling that same pain, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
Well, first of all, I'll say that moments of losing it so you can find yourself are a blessing. You know, my crying in the supermarket led to a very tender conversation with a guy who works there. And now once a week, we're like, I see you. And my side road weep really connected me to the song, to a prayer, to the story, to, okay, I am connected. We are here in ways that we perhaps took for granted earlier. So I think on personal and in collective ways, we are finding ways to cherish what is most needed right now, the essence, the tools for the journey, and discard the excess that we're now cognizant of in ways that are effective. As a mythologist, I will say the myth that I go back to in this story, I mean, we're in the middle of Passover, right? This is a totally human experience. If anything, we are connected to humans in ways that far defy our tribal roots. I think we are finding community right now and solace in ways that are surprising, right? We find tribes. And it's far beyond my minyan, although clearly we're finding meaning in our mythology that unites us. So the story that I'm really interested in as a human right now is the story, this midrash, this myth of the ones who left Egypt. And according to this myth, only one out of five of the Israelite slaves left Egypt. Now it's a beautiful midrash, a reading of a biblical word that says, V'chamushim yatzu bnei Israel. The Israelites left armed is usually the translation, right? M16s. And there are some midrash myths that say they left with prayer, you know, chamushim bitfilah, beautiful, armed with prayer. But another reading says it's not chamushim, it's chamishim. Like, there's, read it differently, it's one out of five. So I'm not big with statistics because my math left brain is not the strongest, but one out of five people, And according to the legend, the other four-fifths died during the plague of darkness because they preferred what they knew. Familiar slavery, familiar narrow straits was preferred to the unknown wilderness with a stuttering elder prophet as a leader. So I'm thinking about my own one out of five. What's in me, the one part of me that says, okay, I'm going to figure this out. And there's four-fifths part of me that want things to be the way they were in many ways, in my own mental patterns and in my things I do and how I want my work to be. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's nice. One part of me needs to forge forward like a brave seedling into a plant. Mm. And for our Jewish community, we got to figure out what's there to be left behind and what's the thing we're investing in. That's the one in five. It's true for the community at large. It's true for America. It's true for absolutely what is not working spiritually, financially, economically, justice. It's not working. And can we have that conversation in a safe and helpful way?
I wanted to go another direction, which is you brought up the fear of the unknown. And so I've been attending Shai Held's beautiful biweekly class on Jewish Live, and we just looked at a psalm. I'm actually not remembering which number psalm it was, unfortunately, but he talked about the sea. So you mentioned, you know, if you imagined how you would leave Egypt, you think it's going to be parting of the sea? Like, and he talked about the sea for us. We don't fully understand what the sea represented to early and to those who might have heard or read these stories a few thousand years ago. Like the Yam, the sea, was the unknown. And for the sea to part and for to go through on dry land was like, it's not only that that's like a miracle flipping around the natural laws of the world. It's like this great terrifying unknown was sort of conquered by God. And that's a big deal. And what I was thinking about, partially because before the show, I warned before the show that I might go in gematria directions, in the Jewish numerology directions, because we were briefly talking about that. But I'm realizing that the word Yam in Hebrew, Yud Mem, is 50. And 50 is the number of days, if you count the first day of Passover, from Passover through Shavuot. So we could understand this 50-day period as sort of a journey through that mystery, through that unknown, through that chaos. And so, and by the way, I'm realizing as I say this, there's the other period of the calendar where there's a sort of lengthy journey through time, Elul. Traditionally, the 30 days of Elul plus the 10 of the high holiday season are associated with a mikvah, which is another water metaphor. But mikvah is not water of chaos. Mikvah is a water that you go through to purify yourself. And so it feels like there's kind of a beautiful symbiosis there on the two sides of the year. But what I'm getting at is, if we choose to see this time as chaos, I'm choosing to see this time as chaos, what are some of the tools that we have from, whether it's Torah or otherwise, what are our tools specifically for chaos? Because God knows we need them right now. What else would you draw on from, whether it's that wilderness story, whether it's the remainder of the Torah or beyond in Jewish tradition to help us through chaos?
I love this. I'm not a gematria guy. My late uncle, Rabbi Yeshua Hagel, loved gematria, and his Shabbos table was just like, I'm like, oh, shut up already. but I like this one. I like that Yam is 50. I want to remind us that Yam is the ancient name of a Canaanite goddess. Like the ancient Semitic metaphors and mythology morphed into what is now the Bible. And Yam is the waters of the world. Going through the sea is back to the womb in some way, or into the feminine divine, which is both chaos and order, right? It's not binary in that way. So there's something about this journey, and I'm grateful that you gave me this 50, because I'm thinking about this journey from the narrow place of Passover to whatever the revelation of Shavuot is upon us. And what does it mean this year? Every day counts, and every day we're counting towards what? When we're out? Someone told me, like, feels like the sharks are circling. So talk about being in the sea. And remembering that our ancestors sang at the end of that ordeal. They had their drums ready to go. They packed with drums. How important the music is, the beat, that uniting thing. And don't forget the myth that has been accumulated in our archives of Nachshon, that it wasn't Moses who broke the water and it wasn't the supernatural CC DeMille fireworks. It was one of the Hebrews, one of the leaders, while everyone was standing and arguing. It's another fantastic myth that there were four camps on the banks of the sea. The group that says, let's go back to Egypt. Let's go back to how things were. And one group that said, no, let's fight them. And one group that says, let's pray. And I think the last one said, let's say, I'm forgetting the fourth. But Nachshon is like the one that says, no, that's the fourth. Are you kidding? Jump in. Boom, he jumps in. And then the sea opens. And then Moses does the thing. Now, that's a crazy, bold, heretical Jewish legend of thousands of years old that says human agency in connection with the power, nature, chaos, order. Very barbarian in its ancient, ballsy Nachshon. And Nachshon has sort of come back in recent years. That's helpful. The human agency, the courage, and it's, again, one in five. It's not everyone. One in four. Like, we have these mathematical grids of how do you respond to a crisis. Other than getting lost in mythologies and stories that I do find helpful, what I'm really finding helpful is that there's a repertoire of what we call mindfulness skills, and that the points of contact that this crisis has brought many of us to are about this three-part structure. It has to do with morning, afternoon, and night. Shacharit, Mincha, Ma'ariv. Stop three times a day. And if you're Muslim, five times a day. And different rhythms for your Christian and Hindu and Buddhist version. But it's really about, forget the words for now. It's about catching your breath. I'm now on, I think, day 30 of the daily soul spa that I'm on every day at 3 p.m. with people to just breathe, catch our breath, see each other, tap into something a little bigger that's holding us, say Kaddish, share healing prayer, let music hold us. Those three things is really what I'm finding all ritual is helpful with. Number one, connect to yourself. Second is connect with somebody else. On screen, I see you right now, I feel you. I can't touch you, I can't smell you, but I feel you. And you feel me. And third is the connection to something beyond, sacred, greater, inner. Wow, there's a bigger force here that's stopping everything. Connecting to myself, finding ways to connect to people out of choice, people who nourish me and whose nourishment I aid, and finding some ways to tap into chaos, the sea, nature, mother, God, spirit, each other, fill in your metaphor. Those are essential tools for survival of the mind, the soul, the body, us.
Along those lines, I think that my impression, or sort of my great sensation when all of a sudden the entire Jewish world and the entire world found itself on Zoom, I said, sort of, my experience was like, welcome to my world. Welcome. You know, I welcome you. Like, I've been here for the last 4 or 5 years, and I've been trying to get you all to come here, you know, and a lot of people have, but a lot of people haven't. And I'm really excited to see them, you know, and I've been really excited to see you, in the sense that, that I live in Chicago and Lab Shul is in New York. And most of what Lab Shul does is localized to the local community. And I've been really excited. And I've told you that I'm getting a lot of spiritual sustenance from basically being a member of Lab Shul. And I mean, I know I should pay now, so I will. But I guess I want to flip that script and say, because I have a sense also that you are welcoming the world to your world, not the digital world, but the, let's say, spiritual world that you have been building in Lab Shul. And I'm curious if you could tell a little bit about it for those who don't know, but also to kind of give a little bit of a sense of what that looks like. Because I think that, and I wrote something about this, and I've talked with this with B'nai Lapi, that I've been thinking about the figure of Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, who comes and visits Moses in the wilderness and gives him this advice, which is typically translated in all kinds of ways. But what really struck me was that Jethro was a man who was already living in the wilderness. And he knew about the wilderness, and he's there to tell Moses, like, welcome to my world. Let me tell you what I know. And I think that in that sense, you know, we're trying to do that digitally, you know, and I think that there's something really deeply spiritual that you can be doing. And not only because of you, but I think because of your community, because I think a lot of the members of the Lab Shul community are Jews or not Jews who have already been living on kind of the wilderness of the Jewish experience. You know, they've already been living outside, many of them, outside of the let's say, norms, the expected ways of being Jewish. And you've built a community of such people. And in a way now, I feel like we're all such people. And so there's something really to learn from the model that you've already built. And I'd love if you could share some of the things that you feel like are working, we're already working the best, and, you know, where you're really seeing resonance from people who may not have been your typical person to join Lab Shul, but now you can see where some of that is actually of value to the folks who, until recently, were living closer to the inside.
Yeah, let's hop from the lofty world of myth to the, wow, here are we now. That's fascinating. And it has been really rewarding to just hop on a Zoom with you and with, you know, friends from all over the country and the world and you know, lurk at this Zoom thing or that thing. And so we're learning something here very valuable that clearly once we cross the sea again, we'll look back. And it's a question of what's going to be left of benefit. I want to throw one more line here that I don't want to lose that was prompted by your questions earlier, and I'll get back to the specifics of Lab Shul now and the digital realm that we've all been, some of us have been really playing with for a while. So there's this verse that I've been thinking of for a while that I told you from the book of Jeremiah, when he's prophesying to the world, and he's talking to Egypt, that at the time was the conquering hero that he was exiled to. And he says, "Klei golata asilach, make yourself tools for exile." There's a larger context there. We're not going to go there. But I remember reading this earlier, like a year ago, and thinking, "Klei golata asilach, what does it mean to have your survival pack, your essentials ready to go? Because you're going to have to leave home in 5 minutes, right? I'm a son of survivors." But that's not really that. It's an older human knowledge of like, okay, boom, what's in your pack? And what does that mean spiritually? What does that mean ritually? What does it mean the basics? And I feel like the work that I've found myself in, the people that I found myself loving and living with and creating community with, either left some of the traditional Jewish tropes or never had them for any number of reasons. And we're looking for a way to bring Jewish into our lives. Well, there are so many other interests and so many other competing values and languages. So the question is, what's the basics? Like, what's going to be something that works for someone who comes to us for Yom Kippur or wants to spend Seder or want to discover Shabbat or is dealing with grief or is getting married? The basics that work for a Jewish, everybody-friendly reality that so many of us, certainly in my community, are living with. So it's brought us to, same as I said before about those three things, self, other, connection, really identify essence, which means we have some halachic, some Jewish legal flexibilities, since I am officially flexidox, or perhaps paradox, it depends, or polydox. And we are in the service of what is the essence here that people can cultivate so that their souls are fed by this tradition and that their humanity is enriched by it. Not Jewish for the sake of Jewish, Jewish for the sake of cultivating the best human that I can be, now more than ever. So we've been doing stuff online, but mostly offline, and we've been for a few years like trying to figure out what does digital look like. Our high holy days online have attracted thousands of people in addition to the thousands in person, so clearly something worked. and we tried a few things. My teachings for the last 2 years, some of my classes have been through Zoom in addition to people in person. And now we've all been beamed up into this new reality. And so we moved into rituals online from the Daily Soul Spa. Oh, actually, let me go back and say that 5 years ago when my father passed away, I was in Israel and saying Kaddish during the Shiva. We arranged a phone call and folks just phoned in and said Kaddish with me. And there were a few hundred people at that first time. And it was so moving. And people shared beautiful words and it was just phone. Then we did it again the following week. And now 5 years later, our weekly phone-in Kaddish, our virtual Kaddish, has between 10 and 100 people, it depends. And one of us takes turns leading a half hour every Thursday at noon. And I wrote a piece about it a few years ago saying we're redefining what is sacred space. From a Jewish legal perspective, I'm going to say in defiance or in with due respect to the 16th century, that you can redefine Makom Echad, one space when we are together, as Zoom. It maybe was not the same for Skype in 2001, which is when Rabbi Reisner wrote a response for the conservative movement. He said no, because it doesn't really feel like one place.
And just to clarify there, that the sort of rule is that you can only say the Kaddish if you have 10 people in a single place. That's the traditional rule.
Well, let's talk about tradition for a moment. 10 Jewish males over the age of 13 in one place. Right. So like many before me, I took out the men clause. Kind of, I think 13 plus is reasonable. Took away whatever Jewish is because we have a very heterogeneous community and then redefined what is space. And I wrote a thing about it and we've been doing it and it's very, very moving that we will say Kaddish. The question is more, we really want to have 10 there so we got people to show up. And then like 3 weeks ago, my brother, Rabbi Benny Lau, working with other Orthodox rabbis, has a psak. It's okay to say Kaddish. And I was like, dude, I told you 5 years ago. So I think we're figuring out Shat Adchak, the Jewish term for like emergency proceedings. And it's interesting to see what's going to be sustained and maintained after. Our virtual Kaddish came from my personal need, which was so nourished by the presence of others, even online. And then people still do it now. And we now have it daily at Soul Spa. And people show up and share. My uncle died yesterday. I lost my cousin this morning. Like, wow. And it's a real circle. It absolutely works. It shows the power, the robustness and the flexibility of our tradition that is rooted like a tree and flexible like a reed that says, okay, boom, adjusting. In the same way that so many seders took place. And for some people, it was like best seder ever. You know, we hosted 1,000 people for second seder. I know you were there. It was like, there were moments that really were able to work. Prayer. I've had moments of prayer this past month, both leading and participating, that really felt like we're connected intimately. So there is a benefit to this connection. We're going to figure out of this, what is the brick and mortar reality of houses of worship? How will JCCs function? What are we going to gain? What are we going to lose with having both the virtual, which is enabling so many of us to connect, and what are we going to need in person? Let's not forget that there are many people who are not able to join us online. I'm in touch by phone each week with about 20 people from the homeless Jewish shelter downtown that I and Lab Shul are involved with. These are folks who are home, who are older, who do not have Wi-Fi or computer. So there's so much benefit here, but it's not going to be instead of. We're going to have to really figure out the both and here.
Yeah, and on that front, I mean, this is a real passion of mine. And on Zoom in particular, first off, I share Dan's feeling from before. It's like for a couple of years when people have asked me, where do you work? My response a lot of days has been Zoom. Like, because on the one hand, I live in Providence, Rhode Island, and where I sit when I do work is in Providence, Rhode Island, sometimes at my dining room table, sometimes at a coffee shop. But like, this is a place where I work more frequently than many others. And on that front, I really want to hammer home what you said about how we have to rethink what a shared space is. And I'm going to do something that won't be this won't register for people listening on the podcast, but it's something I've started doing lately, and it works better at night. But I'm turning my flashlight on, and I'm holding it super close to... Oh, it's, I've got a virtual background, so it's not working as well. But I'm holding a flashlight on my phone up to my camera. And when it's nighttime, I can often see a reflection of that light on the wall in other people's physical spaces that are sharing my Zoom room. We can't feel it, but the light in our actual spaces is refracting through these lenses and actually having an impact on each other's visual space. Like, it's not fake. We call it virtual, but like there is an actual sharedness that happens here, even with that sense of sight. And obviously, if we were to take out our earbuds, like, I could turn the volume all the way up and I could annoy my neighbors with... Not that your words of Torah are annoying, but like, I could turn up the volume and my neighbors could hear you speaking words of Torah, and they would have no idea that it was you and not... I mean, maybe if they were paying close attention, they'd hear it's a speaker. But like, there are ways in which this actually breaks what we have thought of as being in shared space and what we think of as virtual. And so I just want to hammer that home, because what I love right now is... I actually think we're not really even asking those questions. We're so in it that it's like, we're not even asking, does it count? Like, does a minion count right now? Like, there's some of those conversations happening, but mostly what I see people doing is like, oh, Passover Seder arises. I don't really care if this counts as a minion or if this is the same kind of, like, we got to figure out what we're doing. So let's do something.
Essence.
Yeah. Yeah. And that practicality is so important. And what Dan has been hammering home, and what I would echo now, is what we need to realize is this. There are two ways this could go. And I do think on some level it's binary. Of course, it's a spectrum in between. But like, we could, after this is done, whenever that after is, see this as, oh, we had this blip. We had this anomaly. Now we're back to normal. Everything reverts. We had to do Zoom stuff. Now we don't anymore. No more Zoom stuff for the amount that we were doing before. Or we could say, this has helped us to recognize a set of truths that were already there that we need to be able to do, whether it's the Kaddish via phone, via Zoom, whether it's other kinds of gatherings, life cycles, et cetera, via Zoom. Like, this has shown a light on a set of needs that we now are aware of, and we'll never go back. We'll never go back to that Egypt. Not that the Egypt of Egypt is the same as now, but I think there's some parallels. So I guess this opens up a huge set of conversations, but I'm curious, on that sort of after front, like, how is this moment in particular affecting how you think of what the after will be for, I mean, on the one level for Labshul, but really for the Jews, for the world, how is this not in fact just a blip, but something that could help us learn for the future?
I'm going to go back to the 1 in 5 metaphor. And I'm going to say there's going to be a lot of this that's going to be 4 out of 5 that we're just going to leave behind. We'll forget about. I've been listening and reading information about the 1918 epidemic, which was not the Spanish flu, I learned. It was the American flu, for goodness sakes. Completely repressed, denied, lumped onto the war. So much of what happened after economically and socially has to do with that human moment. So we could go into that. I think a lot of people will go into that and prefer to just like get the economy strong and forget about our emotions and what we went through, what we're going through here, and we're not even done yet. But there will be a 1 in 5 that those of us who will need to cultivate that memory will distill, mine out of these days. What are the practices that are connecting us and are worth connecting? What are the practices that we didn't know we need and that we now have at our disposal? And what's disposable? I know we're all feeling it with relationships, with habits, with mind patterns, with this is how I do things, disposable, chametz, done. What's the essence? So what's the 1 in 5? What are the ways in which you connect to self, to other, to larger in ways that are helpful? And what of this are we distilling? I think we're not going to know until we've like really looked at what's in our emergency pack that we organically as individuals and as communities are beginning to discern. I'm an optimistic realist. I think a lot of us, each of us in society, will not maintain the best of this, but we'll go back to some of the patterns that have not been helpful. But I hope that enough of us will remember, and we maintain those basics, and we nourish what we need as individuals in a society. I'm imagining we're going to have more Zoom rituals, but I really hope we're going to have a lot more gardening. Are we going to be able to save our planet when we come out of this? And will the Jewish community, like all other communities, rile up and rise up to protect our own and be part of the global story of redemption? That's my hope. And there is a call for us to have these klei gola, these exile tools of emergency kit of how we save ourselves and save this planet. And time will tell. I'm no prophet. We will look back at these days of quarantine, at the many dead and the plague of 2020. And will we live to say that we left Egypt with great plagues? And we were the Egyptians who said yes to change, and the Hebrews who said yes, or are we going to be those who stay behind? But isn't it amazing that we've got this vocabulary to help us put flesh onto the bones of our uncertainty and at least give us a structure to try and focus? And all that is the gravy to the daily bread of staying present. Where's kindness? Where's compassion? Where's courage? Where's the basics? Brush your teeth, reach out to someone, take a breath, and then mythology.
A vocabulary to put flesh on the bones of uncertainty. That's an incredible phrase for what Judaism offers us. And I'm stating it aloud, echoing your words, because I want to like fully lodge it in my brain and heart for when people ask the why be Jewish questions. That's one of the most succinct answers I've ever heard. So let's keep building that vocabulary to put flesh on the bones of uncertainty together. Thank you, Amichai Lau-Lavi, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
My brothers, thank you. Thank you for spreading your light through your screen to my screen, to the neighbor's screen. What a great way for me to start the day and end Passover together with a sense of purpose.
Yes, and our last words to our listeners, to our viewers, to both, is that we greatly, greatly appreciate being in touch with you, and there are many, many ways for you to do that. If you have questions, comments, thoughts on Amichai's beautiful words today, on anything that Dan and I brought up, or just on past episodes, on what this moment calls for Jewishly, please be in touch with us. Here are the different ways you can. There's our Facebook page, which is, we actually have two now, Judaism Unbound and Jewish Live, all one word for Jewish Live. There's our websites, jewishlive.org and judaismunbound.com. And there are our email addresses, dan@judaismunbound.com and lex@judaismunbound.com. So hit us up at any of those. We greatly appreciate your financial support if you're able to through either jewishlive.org/donate or judaismunbound.com/donate. Any other kinds of support, even just a note of support saying that you appreciate what we're doing right now, if you're not able to commit financial dollars, is totally welcome and appreciated. So thank you so much. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound Live.